Okay, this is side three of session 19, October 9th, 2006. And we were just doing that quote from 1962, and McLuhan says at the end of it, because he can't live with them all, the multiplicity of media, he can't live with them all. That, because you can't live with all the media, then you start to replay the tribal unconscious. You go back for the approximation of the group mind that the electric environment brings in, so you retrieve tribal unconscious, and that's what's been happening the last 50 years. More and more tribal fundamentalism, because you can't live with them all. But that was back then. Nowadays, with the media shrinking, people can live with them all, or at least the android meat makes them think they can. And that began in the 90s, where everybody just got into wanting more and more digital media. Couldn't wait till Windows 95 came out, right?
Well, what would be the difference between being able to live with it all or just thinking that you could live with it all?
Yeah, that's a big difference. People think they're living with it all today, or that they can because the...
They think they're coping with it, but they're not.
Right. And any profession will point out how disastrous any other profession is, and in the end you see that all professions are collapsed. I mean, medicine is a major one. But you can't stop medicine moving more and more into the post-cyborg and being able to handle emergency medicine pretty fantastically, but meanwhile more and more people die of cancer and other diseases. More and more people die in hospitals. So there's a lot of mess going on. So, we come to this next quote, which is a letter to Playboy, written in early February, March 1970. I got these letters by going to the UCLA Public Library in 1977 when Carol and I were living there, and getting the microfilm of Playboy out, and knowing that McLuhan had written letters, and going through several years of the issues, and finding these letters, and this one is a good one. He wrote to Playboy in early 1970, quote, T.S. Eliot's famous account of the auditory imagination, that's in quotes, has become an ordinary form of awareness, but Finnegan's Wake, as a comprehensive study of the psychic and social dynamics of all media, remains to be brought into the waking life of our world, waking in italics. Now, he has auditory imagination quotes, that's like oral tribal man, acoustic space. T.S. Eliot's famous account of the auditory imagination has become an ordinary form of awareness. So that is the retrieval of tribalism. But Finnegan's Wake has not been consciously realized by a large number of people as the manual for media ecology. So you want to read this quote, see what it says to you?
The page 18?
Page 43. Oh, yeah, page 18 of Playboy, yes.
Yeah. T.S. Eliot's famous account of the, quote, auditory imagination has become an ordinary form of awareness, but Finnegan's Wake, as a comprehensive study of the psychic and social dynamics of all media, remains to be brought into the waking life of our world. Yeah, well, I mean, that's obvious. Marshall was the only one that was really seeing the significant how Finnegan's Wake applied to our media environments, and maybe even more than Joyce.
Joyce, in that sense, channeled it, was intuiting something, a strange environment.
As a matter of fact,
when I spoke to Joyce through the Evergreens, he said that he was disgusted by all this new media, and you can read Finnegan's Wake from that point of view. He believed the most important experience was reading and writing. So he was a real literary fundamentalist. But if you read McLuhan on a surface level, you'd think that Joyce was real avant-garde and into new media. But who knows who I was talking to through the Evergreens. It's just interesting. His image was quite different from what how McLuhan presented him.
Yeah, but McLuhan saw that it fit, that it could be used to...
Yeah, he could adapt the old form. He always said the role of the artist is to deal with the new environment and save from the past what is relevant to the present. And Finnegan's Wake was an old artifact, 20, 30 years before, and he knew how to update it and make it relevant to the new situation.
Mm-hmm.
The artist knows what to save from the past.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's waking later on down the line. So you have an interesting thing, that Finnegan's Wake, it's almost like a headline. It could be an ironic headline, like a National Enquirer headline. You know, Finnegan's Wake is a demand to wake up, or it can be a demand to make way for the audience of the paper, newspaper, to wake up, or it can be a conclusion of a Jonestown operation where people were killed. Finnegan's Wake, Finnegan's Funeral. And then it can be also some people thought they woke up, but they didn't. So it can be ironic. There's so many levels. But one way to look at it is it's a newspaper screaming a headline at you.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily represent Joyce's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It's a medium expressing that.
Yeah. But talk about shrinking the media dynamics down to, a pinhead. I mean, it was all right there between those two covers.
That's right. He had everything. Well, he has the whole book on the first page.
I mean, that you can hold the whole, you can, you know, you're talking about the Palm Pilot, you know, being able to operate media environments from within your Palm Pilot. But you could, well, you couldn't operate those media environments from that book, but you could hold the whole thing in your hands.
Yeah, and you can think thoughts and linkage. The internet brings in linkages. People make new connections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of called hypertext. But Joyce was already a hypertext, and every thought possible in the major media implosions we're going to get in the next century, or the amazing matrix pause we're going to experience, all the thoughts you'd get from that, you can get that from Finnegan's Wake, because he's interlinking things every page from all over culture. So he gives you the Matrix experience before it shows up.
Yeah. What was where did Joyce talk about his account of the auditory imagination? I mean, Eliot.
Yes, Eliot.
Eliot, yeah.
That was in his poetic criticism.
Mm.
Criticism and writing about, as a critic, about poetry.
Mm. What did he have to say about the auditory imagination? How did he, distinguish that from other forms of imagination?
Actually it relates to Picasso. Is that the auditory imagination he defined, and it's not the exact words, but basically the point was that the artist, the auditory imagination, knows that all times are existing. And the auditory imagination writes an art form, creates an art form that goes back and retrieves ancient forms of awareness, as well as the most new and trite and superficial forms of awareness. Basically, the auditory imagination knows that all times are happening at this time. And the literate imagination sees time as chronological or sequential and thinks one's evolving from one time to a different time. Not that all time is happening at the same time, but Picasso kind of expressed that when he said, man, we haven't changed at all, when he saw the cave painting. He was sort of consciously or unconsciously or ironically expressing the idea that the sensibility of the auditory imagination, where the most ancient was included in the most present, the most up-to-date. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that all times are happening at once is the auditory imagination.
Mm.
But when you move into the tactile space, I don't think you can say that any time even happened. When you're into the quark reality of the last 50 years, the ability to measure where we're at or to determine a present is impossible. So we haven't even had a time. We don't even have a space. When you were talking about the molecular, not on the tape, but you were talking about the scientists saying the molecular and biological was still sort of time and space, but the quantum was below time and space. That is the chip body. There is no time and space in the chip body. And at best, there's one thing, and even that is unmeasurable, and that is represented by George Bush. Immeasurable, non-moment. So you go past the auditory imagination when you have the digital.
Why do you say there's no time and space in the digital? Because all information is everywhere?
Yeah. You can't separate anything out. It's like a seamless web.
Mm-hmm.
there's no time for a space interval to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan wrote a editorial for the New York Times, an op-ed for the New York Times on September 21st, 1974. It's page L29, if you want to look it up in a microfilm or however you can get that stuff now, whatever mode it's presented in. They still have microfilm in libraries. Yeah, I think they do. So anyways, in that, it was an article called A Media Approach to Inflation. And he talked about, this is in the early 70s, he's saying that the tactile interval has become an object that's exploited by the market and leads to inflation. So he's talking even post-tactile, definitely post-acoustic space, that where you're into a weird new immeasurable time, then the interval becomes the reified object for making money with. An interval is like a space of time, a space of space. But when they're post-interval, then the rearview mirror of the interval becomes the figure, and the new ground is no thing, nothing. Post-information. So he was predicting the Bush era. Okay, so let's see what the next quote is. We got, I'm going back to Understanding Media, 1964, page 19. Of the paperback version. So,
during the mechanical ages, we had extended our bodies in space. Today, after more than a century of electric technology, we have extended our central nervous system itself in a global embrace, abolishing both space and time as far as our planet is concerned. Rapidly, we approach the final phase of the extensions of man, the technological simulation of consciousness, when the creative process of knowing will be collectively and cooperatively extended to the whole of human society, much as we have already extended our senses and nerves by the various media. Whether the extension of consciousness, so long sought by advertisers for specific products, will be a, quote, good thing, is a question that admits a wide solution.
Right, I'm going to read. Now, you can see the idea of cloned ESP in there. Read this. During the mechanical ages, we had extended our bodies in space. Today, after more than a century of electric technology, we have extended our central nervous system itself in a global embrace. That's the seamless web, right?
Yeah.
Abolishing both space and time. We're into a nothing, as far as our planet is concerned. Rapidly, we approach the final phase of the extensions of man, dash, or hyphen, the technological simulation of consciousness, not necessarily consciousness, but the simulation of it, when the creative process of knowing will be collectively and corporately extended to the whole of human society. So everybody will know that's the recently achieved form of consciousness, the recently achieved forms of consciousness we had in an earlier quote from Take Today. So he's talking about a real fused state, and he says, we will extend consciousness just as we have already extended our senses and nerves by the various media. See, it's our senses and nerves, but then this next phase is the tactile interplay called consciousness, or it can be called hyper-awareness, which we quoted from 1962, where humans can't identify with any form, so they are living in a very interesting time of awakened.
Mm.
So we extend our senses and nerves, but then when we extend consciousness itself, that's a pretty strange environment. Whether the extension of consciousness so long sought by advertisers for specific products will be a good thing is a question that admits of a wide solution. So I think that kind of replays what I just said about we're into a no zone. It could be a black hole. Look at the concept of black hole. No light gets out. No expression gets out. It's all bent back down into the black hole, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like if you think of black as negative, you don't have to, but if you do, then this collective consciousness, which we started to simulate in the mixed corporate media interplay of the 60s and 70s, that could look, from a negative point of view, as a black hole.
Mm-hmm.
that wipes everybody's personal and cultural identity into nothing. But then the Android meme, in my terms, comes along and reestablishes you so that the black hole has to adjust to you. It shrinks the black hole.
Well, now to talk about the black holes being eclipsed by talk about this dark matter, dark energy.
Right.
Which they're saying that they think there's more of that out there than there is physical matter that we're accustomed to.
Now, that's a, like string theory is a archetypalizing or turning into an art form the old auditory imagination of acoustic space, since it's a musical resonance as the base of string theory. The dark matter is, that's interesting, I'm just saying this for the first time, that we're now past string theory and we're into tactility as obsolete and turning it into an art form, because the dark energy is the resonant interval, the invisible. The tactile interval has become reified by physicists. So that's a neat breakthrough I made tonight. I've been talking for the last couple of years about string theory as turning oral space into an art form. But just like McLuhan wrote in that article in 1974 about the reification of the tactile interval, it's now approached physics. Dark energy, which is a new thing happening over the last few years, Jack Sarfatti makes a lot out of it, seems to be a new aspect that physicists are exploring. They're actually exploring the invisible, inaudible, tactile interval,
mm-hmm.
and knowing it has some kind of viability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The gap is where the action is now entered physics. It'd be interesting to look at string theory and how that relates to the dark energy. I'll have to see if they talk to each other.
Yeah.
If one is subsumed by the other.
Hmm. Well, there's this void, which is, I guess, the ultimate container. Or maybe you can't even thought of as being a container because it has absolutely no boundaries with which to contain anything. But within,
it can't be translated. Within, that's the Android meme. That's the White House image.
Within the void, which can't be even conceptualized, you have this content, which is matter, which is when we look at all the stars and planets and stuff, and then you have dark energy or dark matter, which seems to be like the unconscious, like the cosmos has its unconscious mind resides in this dark matter or dark energy, and its conscious expression is in the forms of light, the stars and galaxies and planets and that we're all used to. And dark energy, dark matter, probably, I'll bet it's anti-gravity, I'll bet it's relative to gravitational forces, it's sort of anti-gravitational. I'll bet there's a dynamic going on between matter and dark matter, energy and dark energy, to where they are sort of polar opposites in terms of gravitational forces.
Yeah, and cold fusion may be like that. I used to talk about Carolyn's...
Somehow cold fusion would have to be the synthesis or the... It's like taking matter and antimatter, and when you bring them together, you get a burst of... If you could actually bring matter and antimatter together, you would get they would annihilate each other, and there would be some kind of burst of energy, I think.
Yes, it's tapping into the interval in between. Whatever fuses, it's not... total merger, it's an interaction that generates more than the components. So it's the fusion or synthesis and its anamorphosic mutation which becomes a source of energy. It's a distorted source because you can't visualize. It's like some of the medical technologies Carolyn's been involved with. You can't explain them, but they created an interesting... energizing effect and clear out the old baggage.
Mm.
So just like cold fusion would clear out the energy oil baggage, anti-gravity clears out the old visual space version of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that we're manufacturing we're tapping into the tactile interface between first and second nature. If they merge, he says, man bridges art and nature. You know, man himself, human beings are like an interval between animals and gods.
Mm-hmm.
We've always been an interval phenomenon, just like the doubleness that we talked about weeks ago of our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the interval. Mm-hmm. We're the amphibian.
Yeah.
So our technology is an extension of us, so it's going to express the interval.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's consciousness. Mm-hmm. Remember, consciousness is a double process of knowing and growing.
Mm-hmm.
Remember all those things we talked about? Think of consciousness as at every point in its growth, a growing organism has to know what the whole organism is doing in order to develop. Well, we're more and more arriving in a state of collective consciousness. We need to know what everything, what everybody and everything is doing, so we know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's getting a hyper state, which we could call the dream of ESP.
Yeah, there's a, this is kind of a weird segue, but I don't want to forget about it. I heard a slogan, Visa is beginning to do some advertising and through podcast networks. They're wanting to see if that's a viable form of a place to put their money for advertising. And so I was listening to some podcasts, and they're using the same slogan over and over. And the slogan is "Life takes Visa."
Life takes Visa.
Yeah,
yeah. That's a good expression of the Android meme trying to be life, and that's saying the first nature takes and works with second nature. Visa being a technological second nature.
Yeah, and the Visa, the card, is the numbers and the and representing money.
Right. So the merger of
that's kind of like saying life takes money, but it's an update on that. Life takes Visa.
Right. Like the idea is that you got to have money to live.
Yeah, and it's converting people to the idea that it's not like life takes money. Life takes Visa. It's getting people prepared for the cashless society. It's where money's totally virtual.
Right. Now, the thing is you have the fusion of first and second nature done by the Android meme, but it's not the actual breakthrough into cold fusion.
Yeah.
And so in the ads that I mentioned, So You Can Live Large, all these characteristics of the Android meme I describe are showing up in the quotes, in the advertising, in the slogans. So that means it's ordinary awareness now.
Mm-hmm.
The implications of it may not be aware, but it's like T.S. Eliot's auditory imagination has become an ordinary form of awareness. But the idea of Dobbs' cold fusion breakthroughs remains to be brought into the waking life of our world.
Right. Yeah. Also, just to elaborate on that, I mean, what is Visa if not the chip body? I mean, it's just a bunch of ones and zeros inside the chip that represent wealth. Life takes Visa.
And you can play around with VISA. It's VA is. Virginia is. That's the CIA headquarters.
Oh.
It can be S-A-V-I, save-y, save-I, I save.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Joyce would do. He'd play with the iconography of the letters,
mm-hmm.
or of an acronym,
mm-hmm.
like LBJ or HCE or FDR,
mm-hmm.
LSD.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's interesting. No, for Bush, he was W, right?
Yeah.
And that's interesting because the whole 90s was WWW. So he reflected the post-chip body by just being one W.
Right.
And but he's not an acronym. Acronyms for the TV era.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been an acronym lately?
A what?
An acronym.
For what?
Anything.
Oh.
He had LSD. You didn't have one for Nixon.
Oh man! In the world of technology, everything is a TLA, three-letter acronym. Everything.
That's right. Yeah, and even in business, they used to have acronyms the way they write out their business proposals. So what we have, FDR and LSD, those were TV visible icons. Now you have, in technology, icons, but that's in the invisible chip body, so we don't see it in the newspaper world.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
You don't see them. So, in the newspaper world, are there any acronyms that you can think of lately?
No.
Beavis and Butthead. I mean, was it more pairings? Pairings.
Oh, well, let's see. There's a new TV show called The Nine, which I thought was kind of resonant with that group that Arthur Croker used to be involved with.
Not Arthur Croker, Arthur Young.
Arthur Young, yeah, sorry.
And Uri Geller and those guys.
Yeah.
That's a book, The Stargate Conspiracy.
Yeah.
And then I heard someone talking about a show called The One.
Well.
They're like one things, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Like Borgs.
Mm-hmm.
Group Mind is in the titles. So it's not, they don't make it alphabetic anymore because people aren't alphabetic, so you're not going to get alphabetic acronyms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think we'll leave it at that.
Okie dokie.
So we got to page 43, and we only got two more pages for the McLuhan Zone, page 45 and 47.
Right.
But maybe we'll do some LaRouche next session, and then go back to McLuhan.
Yeah. A little reprieve, McLuhan reprieve, and then do some LaRouche and back to McLuhan.
Right, because maybe we'll think of some interplay between McLuhan and LaRouche when we do LaRouche.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds good.
You know, some things we have worked with on McLuhan may be evoked when we start doing LaRouche again. Okay.
Okay, that's it for now. Signing off.
Okay, thanks a lot, Scott.
Okay, thank you, Bob.